You're listening to another episode of the Zealous Podcast. I'm your host, Rocky Snyder. This week, I get to invite Lance Walker onto the show. He not only is a fellow Perform Better presenter, but he is the director, the global director of performance at Michael Johnson Performance. He's in charge of global operations for the company in the US, China, and England. He's got his bachelor's degree in physical therapy and a master's degree in exercise physiology from the University of Oklahoma. He has been the assistant strength conditioning coach for the Dallas Cowboys and all around great source of insight and information. So make sure you subscribe before you click that play button one more time, and I hope you enjoy the show. So Lance, we've only got a couple of weeks to go presenting for Perform Better. Why don't we kick it off with the Perform Better 3-day summits back in person, which is fantastic. We've got three locations, Orlando, Providence, and just outside the Chicago area. And they're kicking off the first week of June. There's one in July. And lastly, in Providence, it'll be in August. So you're going to be in Orlando, is correct?
Yeah, Orlando is my stop this year. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, that's good. We'll actually be face-to-face. This will be nice because I'll be there as well. What are you talking on? What's your presentation?
I'm looking forward to sharing. I think over the last couple of years, obviously, we haven't done any travel to speak of. And before that, I was doing a ton. So I got a chance to kind of scam the world of high performance and steal a bunch of stuff. I say steal. We don't steal. I mean, I think we all probably do, right? I've stolen some of your stuff. And I say steal with the right, you know, in the right way, is that I humbly used it and given you credit, you know, when it's not mine, because none of it's mine. But the last 20 years, the last 10 years, I've seen a lot of really interesting things that made me scratch my head and go crying my beer at night. And I want to share some of those things with the group in Orlando, and then go into a practical where I'm going to show you how kind of I iterated that learning into my setting. And play with some of that new stuff, or some of the stuff you've probably seen before, but hadn't really applied it in your setting. And some of it, you're like, "That's crazy! I can't believe you would use that." So hopefully, anyway, it's a head scratcher for some and an epiphany for others.
That's cool. Without giving away too much of your talk, for sure, what's something out there in the realm of outside the U.S. that has really piqued your interest as of late, like in the last few years? What has made you go, "Ooh, okay, we've been doing this now, you and me collectively, you know, if we add up the years, it's a long time, but we're probably each about between 25 to 30 years we've been doing what we've been doing." So you think that you've covered all the bases, when the last thing that's farthest from the truth. What's piqued your interest?
Well, some of it's the cultural things that I've learned. You know, we're grinders. We're always grinding in this space. And what I learned when I got out of the United States as a strength conditioning coach, and I got into whether it's Western Europe or South America or even Asia, is that we got to do a better job being human beings, being social, being, you know, networking, working with each other, talking to each other. You know, I feel like I need to anyway. It was really, that was one of the biggest learnings, was more of the soft side of our profession was networking better, being a community. And I think these sort of podcasts are a great part of that. But what I came back with, every time I would go across an ocean and come back, I was like, I got to reach out to more of my colleagues on a personal level. I got to go visit them. I got to go break bread with them. I need to get on an airplane or get in my car and go drive and see them do what they do, and invite them to come see and do with me what I do. And so much more of that happens, what I saw anyway, internationally, than happens here in the United, or what I've done in the States. It's very egocentric for me to say everybody does it like this. I'm sure maybe some, you know, some are better than others, but there's a lot more sharing that goes on, and so much more learning goes on in that, you know, that live, that being in person with somebody at their spot, watching them do their stuff, or them at your spot, or doing it together, than you do on, you know, these sort of interactions that are good. They're good primers, but that was number one, really, is a cultural thing, that coaches networking together, sharing best practices in this setting versus when they really get in, you know, under the same roof or out on the same pitch. It's exponential what you get when you do that. So that's probably point one, is that's where innovation and hybridization really is going to take place. And I think I know I'm doing a better job of that now, and I'm asking everybody in the training community to do a better job as well.
Well, I got to say, I'm not doing a great job at that either. Although you know, granted, there's some colleagues that we get on almost on a weekly basis in Canada, Australia, Ireland, England, and here in the US, that we all are kind of educators in one approach. And so we get on and we collaborate that way and we do like mentoring and so on. But aside from that, like actually physically going to other locations, yeah, you got me there. And it sounds like a great, honestly, it's not falling on deaf ears. I would love to do that. But why do you think that is? Why is it that we don't do it here? Is it the competition? Is it the ego? Is it the difficulty of travel? How come it occurs outside of here more prevalent?
Yeah, I can only speak for myself, I guess, and my colleagues that we're too busy. In my case, I feel like they're too busy. You know, I don't want to impose, you know, I don't want to, hey, I know they've got a full plate, and the last thing I want to do is go in there and mess that up. They've got their work to do. So part of it, I think, is just the fact of respect of each other's time. There may be a little bit of ego there. There may be a little fear of exposing what you're really doing versus what you tell people you do at a conference. I mean, I've seen that in my own world. It's a lot easier to stand up in front of people and espouse what it is that, you know, the perfect system and this is how it all works and all that versus what you're really doing day to day when the rubber meets the road. And we all know that those two things are probably not the same, right? I mean, it's just human nature to put up there the best case scenarios in your presentation and not the failures and the challenges and the nuances of how you adapt that to fit this. And for me, that's the art of this profession is taking what we know is, you know, gosh, reps and sets and programming and all this cool stuff. But then how do you apply it in a mass setting when you got 40 people and 20 of them are sore from the last workout and you didn't expect that? Or all of a sudden, you know, the rack systems are all taken from the track team and now I've got to use this for the golf team. How am I going to, you know, operate in the, for me, that's the real watching the artists work and watching these folks with this amazing wisdom and amazing ability to change and to augment and to optimize. I think that's probably what I like to see the most, but that might be the most, you know, some people might think, well, oh no, they're going to come in and see me do stuff that I didn't talk about. Or they're going to have to see me how much of a crazy smattering this thing really is. It's messy, right? And I'm okay now with saying, hey, every day is a complete mess. I mean, it's absolutely a complete mess. It's like the Wizard of Oz, right? That movie that we all, or that my generation loved, you know, where you're standing in front of the wizard and all the crazy smoke and all the cool, you know, techno, you know, everything else. And they're wowed by that, right? And then little Toto, the dog, runs over and pulls the curtain back. And there's that guy standing back there moving all these levers like a crazy person. I mean, it's the pulling back of that curtain, I think, that scares a lot of folks. It doesn't scare me anymore like it used to. But that's where the magic happens. I mean, it's, and we all have that curtain. I mean, I think we do. Think learning, getting behind that curtain is kind of, it's hard for folks. I guess it's hard for us to pull the curtain back ourselves or to invite people in or to pull it, have them pull it back. I think I'm just speaking for myself. I don't know.
No, well, you're speaking for me too. I've got to tell you, you nailed it so perfectly for my own day-to-day operations. Like the concepts are fabulous. The methodology is founded in physics and biomechanics and all this other scientific information. But the rolling out process is so chaotic. It's so non-linear. And what I strive for so often is, can we create a linear path? And pulling back my curtain, you're going to see chaos supreme. And yet at the same time, I can't be too hard on myself because it seems to be working for a lot of people. Could it be done better in a more succinct fashion that may even improve performance to the next level? I would love to find out, but this brain does not operate that way. It sure would be nice my wife is the backbone of our operation here, and she's very linear in her thought process, which of course, you know, my process will often drive her nuts because I'm just all over the board. But no, it's really refreshing to hear that. So with that being said, you've got to have some good systems in place. I mean, you've got to have a winning recipes because you've been doing this for so long. What are some of those ingredients into your winning recipe, albeit, you know, the chaos behind the curtain.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. I think I learned again what you just said. And as I traveled the world and saw that successful programs and people is they had a system. They didn't have a recipe. They had a system. They had a template. They knew what they were going to cook today. They're cooking barbecue today. And, you know, they ran out of whatever. They could still cook barbecue, right? And everybody knows we're cooking barbecue, but it allowed for more of a bumper plate or a bumper setup instead of a hard, fast recipe book. And so, yeah, the system, I think you said it, is part of the key, is having a system, having a big sort of a big picture plan. You know what the month is about, what the week is about. You know what today is about. You know what this segment of the whatever the session is that you're trying to get. You know what it's about. And that keeps you on a bearing, on a heading, on a compass heading. And I think that's number one. And then being able to be a little more nimble within that space and having that system then that can be replicated outside of you is something I've seen internationally, is they do a great job of replicating that systems-based thinking in their athletes, in their clients, in their trainers, you know, so they can replicate that ability to allow that trainer or that athlete to be the unique thing that they are. You know, you as a coach, if you were coaching in my system, I would want to give you the parameters that we're shooting for and allow you to be Rocky in that system, you know, allow you to be, you know, hey, I'm a little bit better over here and over there. And it becomes sort of your methodology, I guess, inside of a grander system versus just hard press. Hey, Rocky, you're going to do this, 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 and this. And a good example of that too, is with the athletes that I see. I saw this at some of the English Premier League clubs that we visited. You know, these players come in and each of them has a different thing that they like to do and don't like to do, you know? And so today, if it's a striker for Arsenal and they're walking in the weight room to get their lift in game day minus one or two, I mean, it's pretty important that they, you know, you don't force them into doing stuff that they really don't like to do or don't trust. And especially if it's an older player or a top flight, you know, maybe the guys lesser on the roster or the younger kids, you can kind of pigeonhole them a little bit more, but you got to talk to that athlete and find out, hey, how you feeling today? Today on the menu today is going to be some sort of whatever it is, squat pattern. Well, this is what I'm prescribing, but hey, based on the feedback, based on what you like, what you don't like, what you have confidence in, being able to augment and adjust that to fit them for the day. I used to be the old school strength coach that, you know, by golly, we're doing squats today, Rocky. So get your butt in squat rack. And I thought that there was some sort of power, magical power in making people do what they really didn't want to do. And that there was some sort of mystical thing that happened because, yeah, the thing they don't want to do is probably the thing they need to do. And nah, not really. I mean, it's kind of meeting them in the middle somewhere. Now, if the guy says, hey, I don't like any squats, I want to do some more, you know, bicep curls, you know, then you're going to have to sell that. And I've seen that as well, where the really good practitioners are able to kind of sell that, hey, we got to get this done, you know, and then the reason that we got to get this done is that, 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 and it's going to top up this, it's going to help with your speed on game day. And if we miss it again, that's going to push us outside of a 5-day window. And we're probably going to have lost some strength on you. So we can't, you know, and that's the repercussions of that is a negative. I try to paint the positive first, but that's an area I think that I've also learned and I'll be sharing with the group in Orlando is how to kind of micro adjust inside of the macro. And I think the real artists in our field are able to do that and do it a lot better than maybe I did it in my younger days for sure. But that's a key, I think.
Right on. Well, I'm looking forward to that talk for sure. You brought up old school coaching, and this takes me to this interview I saw you on, and you were talking about the fact that old is new and old things that were taken again, then were putting aside, and then were taking. It's this constant evolution of strength and conditioning is where you were going with this. And I gotta say, over the course of these several decades of strength conditioning and personal training and whatnot, I look back and I often will cringe because at the time, just like now in this very moment, we are doing the best we can. So we can't knock that. But when you look back, I feel like we're so young in our industry and the growth of what we're trying to achieve, that we are still, we're toddlers. We're just, we're standing up, we're falling over, and almost like in a somewhat barbaric sense, where we just throw stuff around and put it on down, and this was the way that you do it. Like, I guess, I don't know if I even have a question about that, but I just want to talk about, you know, the evolution of our industry and where it's come and where it's going. And honestly, where are we now? Where do you see us now in our growth chart?
Yeah, I wish I knew where we were. You know, don't you wish you could just pull up and kind of see the big, you know, the end of the story and know how far into the textbook we are? I mean, sometimes that's frustrating.
Yeah.
But you get enough age on you in anything, and I think you start feeling like you're somewhere in that. At any point, you either don't know anything or you know everything, and then you don't know anything, you know everything. And I don't know, they got to, whatever that effect is, and they've talked about it. I know Mike Boyle talks about it a lot and some others. But I'm constantly on that roller coaster. I'm never, one, very, very confident in what we're doing, and two, very completely off that I'm completely wrong. And it's almost like I'm on a daily undulation now. So I don't know where we are as a profession, but I can tell you this. I think in generally speaking, after you get that first 3 to 5 years of your profession, that's when the learning really starts. You know, I think as a physical therapist, that's something I learned, and my clinical instructors always told me, they said, you're going to suck really bad for the first 3 years, and you're not even going to know it. You're not going to know how bad you suck. And he said, Dr. Mark Anderson was my mentor at the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center. And he said, and that's something that's going to be very helpful for you when you can reflect back on that, but then also to help those that come through your clinical affiliations with that same concept and to be okay with that. And I think we're all kind of doing that all the time, though. I mean, I think I probably sucked, you know, last year or last week on some things that I didn't even know. So that's the spooky part, is I don't know where we are on it as a profession. I know where I am as an individual on it, is that I feel very frustrated at times, because I do feel like as a profession, we may be doing more iteration than innovation. It's always a tweak of something old that's new again, as you said. And I like that. That's great. That's definitely a part of the you know, the growth of a profession, is iterating on the old. Things like isometric training. We're starting to see the rise again of isometrics. I mean, some folks think that's brand new. That's been around for many decades.
And Charles Atlas. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Think about some of the isometrics. We had load cells at the University of Oklahoma's lab in the early 90s that we were using and doing ISOs. And even then, it felt a little old school. But now, adding technology on top of that, some of those load cell technologies, and it kind of revitalized isometrics, I think. I mean, I think it's kind of brought it back out of the sticks and cobwebs, and we're starting to see it be revitalized. And so maybe it's the data and the technology that comes back and pumps life back into things like isometrics that were once old school and makes them new again. And I love that. I think we need to continue to do that. And I'm not throwing shade on that at all. I do that all the time. Where I feel like innovation, though, is maybe where we're lacking. And there's some innovators out there. I mean, there's some folks that are probably on your podcast, too, that have been innovative. Gray Cook was an innovator when he started trying to pull physical therapy into the strength conditioning and training space. That was very innovative, I thought, even though it was old stuff. Wasn't old, it was physical therapy-esque type things. It was a different profession that he sort of pulled in and began to leverage inside of, for us as trainers to begin to use. And that's the sort of innovation that I see as that second level innovation, where it's, let's pull from other philosophies or other, not even philosophies, other fields. You know, if it's sports medicine, if it's sports science, if it's technology, if it's art, if it's communication, if it's music, if it's creativity. I mean, I think that's where it's almost a collaboration that you start to see in the music industry. You see that a lot, where these two artists come together and they collaborate. So maybe collaboration sits in that space too. But then it's that third level of innovation that I really think we're ripe. And that is just off the wall. We've got to solve problems. And so I think instead of trying to iterate the problem solving that we're doing now, let's look at the problems that we're trying to solve up here on the other end. Let's not even look at equipment or exercises or rep sets or whatever. Don't even look at that. Let's look at problems we're trying to solve. So get that completely off your radar and just look at problems. What are some problems? I mean, I don't know. Performance-wise, injury risk. Are we really reducing injury risk? Well, some would say yes. Some would say no. Research would say probably. Then why has ACLs continue to climb? You know, we got to be okay. I got to be okay with asking that question. And then trying to solve backwards for that instead of trying to make what I'm doing better to try to meet up in the middle. Maybe we need to look at it completely by itself. And I know there's some that are doing that. Hewitt and some others are doing a great job in that space. But if that makes sense to the listener, is that just look at the problem you're trying to solve. That athlete needs to whatever. They need to be able to catch that nine route on that right side. And the reason they're not catching it right now is X, Y, and Z. And then how am I going to solve for that as a performance expert? This person's constantly, you know, unavailable for matches because they're chronic hamstring problems. How am I going to solve for that? Not what am I going to do with my program to build back up to that, build backwards from that. And maybe that's going to help us with innovation. And some of that's going to bleed back into collaboration. So collaborating with sports science, physiotherapy, the multidisciplinary, I mean, I think that's probably pretty commonplace. And it may bleed all the way back into some old school. One of the old school, I think the interview you're talking about, we may have been discussing the role of eccentric training. I know you've had Cal Dietz and some others talk about isometrics and eccentrics. Well, eccentrics have, again, that's not a new thing, been around a long time, but looking at eccentrics in a different way and applying technology in ways to eccentric training that maybe helps answer some of those harder questions up the chain there, you know, in terms of that hamstring injury or that performance, or maybe off in left field. One of the reasons, you know, that we started iterating our programs early days was none of our athletes, I'll be honest with you, none of them really like to train. You know, they train because they're trying to get ready for their sport. They love their sport, but they don't love, you know, they don't love lifting weights. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I do, because I was a fitness guy and, you know, I like that kind of stuff. But most of our athletes and maybe some of our clients that we train, they don't love it as much as we do. They're doing it to get something out of it. And so I start sitting on that side of the audience, looking into it, going, how can I make it, you know, better, but more efficient? How can I make it more fun? How can I make it where it's connected more to what's important to them? And it's usually doesn't have anything to do with the weight room or with the sprint training that we're doing. It's always something else. It's something in life. It's an event or it's a competition or it's a sport. And so I think there's some innovation there, whether that's through technology, whether that's, you know, we create Roblox environments for kids to be able to compete in Roblox, to be able to get after some of the activity thing. I don't know, but I think it's going to take more of a community outside of sports medicine, sports scientists, sports, you know, performance, coach, strength and conditioning. We've done a pretty good job, I think, in that space of sort of opening up and learning and sharing and collaborating. I think it's probably time to get out of that circle and start pulling some wax in. I mean, and we would think they're wacky, right? So it's whether it's a cello player that understands how to manipulate the cello in ways that, you know, we've never thought about. Why would they play that like a beatbox? That's a cello. It forces us into a space of going, man, that dumbbell, that thing could be better. Let's use it this way. That barbell could be better. That drill that we thought was doing, it just forces us, I think, or forces me into a more creative space, a more, I hate to say it, artistic space, but as long as I can line it up and attack certain problems with that, I think it's healthy to go that side of things instead of going the other way where I'm just trying to iterate that exercise to make it a little bit better to approach that problem over there, taking a completely different approach. So that's sort of the three levels of innovation that I'm most excited about. I'm not going to complain that we're not there, but I do think that's, if we look at it through that lens, that far right on the continuum, we got a long ways. I'm not even sure we've really gotten into that space yet. You know what I'm saying? I think technology has crept in there, but I'm not sure we're even, as a profession anyway, in that space yet. There's some that are doing some really cool stuff, but that's the area that excites me. And I think I'd like to be part of the evolution of the field, not just the revolution. You know what I mean? Where we just revolve back and constantly let's run it back again. Well, look, my first job at the University of Oklahoma in 93. And there was a great program in Oklahoma, right? Everybody knows Oklahoma football. Mm-hmm. One of my first jobs there was to throw out all the old medicine balls. Medicine balls out. Well, get the medicine balls out because medicine balls is old school.
Yeah.
Now think about that. That's 90.
Revolution.
And so now guess what? Oh gosh, that same medicine ball. There was nothing wrong with the medicine ball. It was out of vogue at that point.
Right.
It's come all the way full circle. And we're now throwing out the Nautilus machine, whatever the machine-based movement that we had to make room for by throwing that out. We're coming back, and now there's no machines in a weight room. So I saw a weight room in England. I'll share this with the group, and it performed better in an English Premier League club that had no weights in it. It was the gym, but it had no weights in it. And it reminded me of some of the old black and white, gyms that you would see on PE, PE programs.
Sure.
But it was techno out the wazoo. I mean, technology everywhere. But those are the kind of things that make you go, gosh, does a weight room really need to have barbells and dumbbells and racks and things? Or are we just trying to make it consistently make that better and better and better? Or there's some paradigm shifts out there that we're missing. I think there are, and I'm excited about that. I'm also scared to death by that, which I'm good with both.
I'm glad that you weren't talking innovation just solely in regards to technology, but you went in every tangent imaginable, it seems, even bringing in a cello player, because I think there's so many elements that we're needing to consider. One, just the advancement of technology is reducing the need to move, and therefore the athletic population, even though it's popular in our field, it seems that over the whole world population is shrinking because the global Americanization of culture, like fast food and less activity and all these things are actually creating a smaller population of the athletes in the world. So, there's that to contend with. And the fact that the individuals that are coming in today from a structural standpoint, from just a movement standpoint, are moving with less quality than when we were in our teenage years. Now, when we're talking about the 70s or the 80s, and then we look beyond that, and with the advancement of labor-saving, time-saving devices, that comes at like Mike Boyle will say, an orthopedic cost. Right? There's always that to contend with. So that's really interesting. Now you're talking about all these different elements, which made me think about. We only have so much time in a conditioning program, and it's usually measured by hours and half hours, right? And for some reason, when this all began, we were given this allotted amount of time, and no one's really questioned that. It's not like, hey, this is only going to be a 10-minute routine today, or this is going to be for 3 hours. No one's really going into those extreme spectrums, but granted, within the time frame that you have created, there are certain elements of strength and conditioning and preventative measures and restorative and all these things, how do you find the ability to fit them all in? Do you just, obviously you'll expand on one area while constricting somewhere else, depending upon the individual, but do you start, obviously we can't pull much more of our hair out of our head these days, but do you get yourself really kind of, God, I need a beer after thinking about this. Yeah. How am I going to fit all this stuff in?
Yeah, you're right. And you don't, if you're trying to fit it all in, you got too much, right? I mean, I think Gray may have told me that once. I asked him many, many years ago, corrective exercises. Gosh, I got all these corrective exercises I need to do with this person. And he asked me, I can't remember where it was. It's going to date me, but it would have been in the early part of his career. And I asked him, I said, well, if I've got this and I've got these, 12 exercises I want to do with this athlete, what do I do? And he said, well, you need to be like a really good physical therapist would be. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you don't have time for all 12 of those exercises, do you? And I said, well, I could make time, I guess. He's like, no, that doesn't show your prowess as a physical therapist. In fact, it actually indicts you as not being very good And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, it's kind of like throwing darts at the you're throwing a bunch of darts at a dartboard, and you're trying to kill it with quantity." And he said, "You got to start taking some of those darts away." And I was like, "Oh." He said, "Yeah, what I would do is I would take those 12 darts and cut it in half." And so he'd send you back to your okay. I have those 12. What are the six I really got to go with? And I said, "Is that what you mean?" He said, "No." He said, "Now cut that in half again." And I went, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, cut that in half again." That was really sage advice from him. And it helped me as a therapist. It helps my other therapists get better with their diagnosis, with their targeted approach. If it takes 12 things, you don't really know what they need. Is all 12 going to be fine? Sure. But if you really know what they need, you really have the tools lined up in your toolbox and know how to use those tools. And they're not just a smattering of tools that you picked up at, you know, Lowe's the other day. I mean, heck, I bought some tools the other day. I don't know why I bought them. I don't know how to use that tool. You know, I don't even know why I bought that. You know, I mean, it's sitting in my toolbox. I might use it as a hammer, and it's actually for screwing in stuff. So we fill up our toolbox with all this, you know, cool stuff. And then we're looking at our toolbox. Well, we got to use those things now versus, okay, what tools am I really an artisan with, and apply that to this diagnosis or to this challenge or to this performance problem? And I think by chopping it up into those segments, and it really forces you to prioritize, is basically what it does. To your point, prioritizing those 12 things that could all be fine and good, and bringing it into those three that you know you got to hit these three things. And if time allows, it's going to be 4, 5, and 6. And then if it's you got all kinds of time, it's going to be what, you know, 10, 11, and 12. And then that priority might change based on, okay, they came in at one of the soccer clubs in South America. We were working with Fluminense. We had a great program set up for this group of junior athletes that were going to come off the pitch, and we were going to get them through X, Y, and Z. They were going to get a strength program. They were going to get some corrective stuff and then some recovery work. Well, guess what? The soccer coach kept them an extra 25 minutes on the pitch, and then they showed up and they had already conditioned. So he conditioned them. I mean, we didn't know that. Now, if your coaches that are listening have never dealt with that, they're lying to you. Of course they have. It happens all the time. You know, I plan for a 40-minute session. He spent an extra 25 minutes on the turf with him and conditioned him. What am I going to do now? I mean, am I going to pull my hair out and go, "Well, let's just start where we start and we'll get what we can get and we're going to run out of time"? No, instantly you're chopping, right? You're chopping it down, and you've got those bold rocks that you're going to boom, boom, boom. These are going to be the three things that we hit on. Des Ryan at Arsenal called it, with his performance program, I think he called it a fast session. When he would get hit with that, he was always ready for that fast session. You know, the guys are going to come in, they're going to be either tired, they spent too much time on the pitch or longer than in plan. And he knew exactly what his priorities were going to be. And he was going to knock those things out of the park, even if it was as little as 10 minutes of what was supposed to be a 50-minute session. And I think that's great for us as practitioners to think like that, to build out of those big rocks. And even physical therapists, any of those are listening, I know I do that in my practice now too, is I want to whittle it down. If I'm working with you on your Achilles, I'm not going to give you 12 things and do, you know, just kind of smatter it. I'm going to start with the three. We're going to kill these three things. And that forces me to really know what is best, what's best for you, what's best practice, what's evidence-based, what I've worked in before, what tools I have the most confidence in. And when I do that, it really opens up time. All of a sudden you can do the big rocks better. You're focusing on that. You're not watering them down. And then it allows you to sort of augment and place those other things in as they go. And it makes the meal better. It's like a good meal, right? You put a little, you know, you got the steak right there. And then, yeah, we do have time for some potatoes. Let's put a little color over here and let's add a little pat of butter over here. And all of a sudden it's a full meal, but you all know that steak, that's the deal. It's all about the steak today. And I think that's helped me as a practitioner. I know that speaks to general things, but I think it's prioritization. And that speaks to wherever you are in your season. I could give you specific examples, but I think it's more general around what Gray talked about, what you want to do, what you need to do, and then what you have to do. And I think as long as you know those things, you can adjust on the fly, so to speak.
All right. So with those like three big bucket items, the big rocks, how has that changed over, say, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago? What have they been the same? Have you just tweaked them a little bit? Or have you taken one of those out and replaced it with something else? What are they today? Yeah. And what did they look like before? Yeah.
I think one of the big epiphanies for me is I'm a strength and conditioning coach first. That's what I was first. Well, so what's the biggest rock? What's the golden hammer? What's the thing that, you know, you walk into every construction site with? It's strength, right? So, I mean, yeah. I'm going to beat them up with strength, and that's my golden hammer. That's going to help with strength. It's going to help with mobility. You got a speed problem, it's going to help with that. You're always getting injured, it's going to help with that. You get my drift. I mean, we just walk in and we're swinging this golden hammer. And I still am to some extent feeling like, wow, that's invincible. I mean, it always wins, right? Every single time it always wins. And I'm not convinced of that anymore. I'm not convinced that it always wins. And so,
So that's what I want to talk about. That moment that you just realized, maybe that's not the golden hammer after it. Maybe it doesn't. When was that? What? Because it happened to me. Same thing. I just lift. And then suddenly it was like, maybe 75% of the workout shouldn't be just about lifting stuff and putting it back down. And today it's more like, to be honest, it's maybe 15 to 20% on a solid program that I'm working with somebody. Yeah. When was that moment? Do you remember?
Yeah. I don't remember an exact time. There was a period of time when at MJP, we worked with a lot of fast humans. I mean, we had five of the fastest humans walking the planet right now in our space. And I got to assess them. I got to work with them and interact with their coaches and learned a ton. And this is just about fast people. So it's one of those epiphany moments. And I started really realizing something that the research has basically told us anyway, is that things like strength, you know, just basic strength, like squat strength, or things that we felt like we can control as strength coaches, had almost zero correlation with being fast. You know what I mean? It was like, yeah, well, if so-and-so is the fastest human, he should also, or she should also be equally one of the strongest in this, you know, this thing that I can control and that I understand. And it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, it really didn't line up. Now, converse to that, if we made a kid stronger over here, right in the rack, did they show up as faster? A lot of times they did, especially the young ones and the developing ones, right? I mean, it helped. So it was very easy for me to say, well, you know, that's just an outlier. Let's just, you know, let's focus on who I'm developing over here, and it's all going to help them. And for me, it became, okay, look, I get that. I just can't look at it from that one direction backwards. I've got to really open up to this concept of, do I need to build backwards from this development model, or do I need to look at the outliers and begin to learn a little bit about that, how they got to that, if they're wanting to be faster, and build from that way into the weight room instead of from the weight room out to them? It would be one example. And when that happened, you know, it still happens. I'll be honest with you. We all probably still go back to strength.
Yeah.
We all do it. I still do it.
Knee jerk. It's a complete knee jerk reaction.
And it works. How can we not? There's nothing wrong. I'm not. Yeah, it works. Strength works. But you're right. If 30 minutes of strength, if it's more targeted, like we talked about before, maybe that turns into 12 minutes of strength, because now it best fits what that athlete needs in that situation for movement, quality, or speed, or what. You're attacking it differently than the golden hammer approach, where let's just get them stronger, bigger, faster, stronger. That's the mantra. And saving some of that time for those other areas. And one of the areas for us that's changed, I guess, and it's starting to change, I think, obviously in the entire profession is movement training. It's coming back. You know, the concept of some of the things that Gary Gray talked about early days back in the, and I say early for me, this would have been early 90s, mid to early 90s, when I got to meet and listen to Gary talk about what he termed functional training back in the day. Blew my mind as a strength coach. I'm like, wait, what? You know, we're going to do these weird angles and these weird funky, and you're going to tell me that the subtalar joints, you know, can communicate up to the scapula and all that. Blew my mind. And I was in graduate school in the physical therapy program, and that blew my mind. And so I'm also a strength coach. I'm thinking, this guy just blew me away with this. And then my initial thing was reaction was, yeah, that's, I'm going to ignore that. That's ridiculous.
Oh, I'm so glad you say that. Yeah, I was talking to Gary about that. A client of mine brought me in a VHS tape with the Matrix on it. And they're like, oh, you got to check this out. And there's Gary doing his Matrix movements with these dumbbells and all that. And at the time, my ego was so big and I was all about strength, and I'm seeing him moving all these directions. I'm like, yeah, that's good. That's okay. That belongs in an aerobic class or something. Okay, cool. And I just gave the tape back. And now, of course, you look back and going, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Had I just taken the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth, who knows where you'd be now. So thank you. Thank you for letting me know. I'm not alone in the world.
And I think that's what I do naturally is if it's hard for me to wrap my brain around it, it's much easier for me to stick to stuff I know that works. So that was a big game changer for me too, was thinking about things he called it functional, but it was movement and it was coordination. Yeah. And it was linking the neural with the wet mass of muscle and tendon and bone. And that was, it overlaid for me two professions, strength training and that conditioning side, but also as a physio, it made a whole bunch of sense when I was able to really start to chew on bits of that. I still don't understand everything Gary says. I mean, I don't. And I think some of us probably feel like, well, that's just shock jock stuff. He's just trying to blow you away with all this. No, I mean, that's how crazy perhaps movement really is. And our understanding of it is so minuscule right now that may be where we need to sit, is in that really wacky kind of space we think is wacky, but it is movement. And specific to where we moved our needle the most was how do we be more movement based with our training versus strength based? So let's focus on what movements are we trying to improve? And for us, speed. I mean, speed was obviously for us an important one. It had to be for what we did. And for so much of those years, we had to look at it from a speed component into those other areas, conditioning, strength, nutrition, injury prevention, but it was all about the movement first. Mm-hmm. And if it didn't reach back up into the speed continuum, whether that's multidirectional or linear or both, for most of our athletes, it needed both, then we were building it from the wrong perspective forward. So that's what I think is where it helped me the most, was thinking about it in terms of movement based. And Mark Verstegen was a pioneer in that space, right? He was one of the first to kind of look at it from a movement first lens. And I think that was a paradigm shift for our profession. We just continue to tunnel down into that. That's one. And then two is age specificity. I mean, we really started seeing some really unique stuff and trends. And I know the PhD community and they do a great job with the data that's coming in to make it more evidence-based all the time. We need more evidence. We need more diving into the kid thing, because I think the kid thing, unfortunately, we're still probably looking at that as a very get them stronger, you know, looking down through that lens of the strength and conditioning world instead of up from the movement world. And then also from the age-specific world, there's some real opportunities. And we started seeing that in our own data. We're starting to see that, I think, in some of the literature as well, that there is some nuances there based on age, that it's something that will bring that focus and that prioritization deeper in. If you've got 12 things that you want to do, if you know the age specificity to those things and that synergistic adaptation that Avery Fagenbaum talks about and some others, it allows you to prioritize where are you going to get the biggest return on your investment? It's not about what you want to do and what you like to do. If that 12-year-old walks in, they're 12, their maturity level is this. This is their training age. I could do a bunch of stuff and they're going to get better. I mean, that's the great thing about our profession, right? I mean, heck, throw anything at them and they get better. But I've only got this much time. And I want to get the biggest bang or the deepest penetration that I can with what I'm going to do, the biggest impact. If I'm going to chop down from 12 down to 3, what are those 3 things going to be? Mm-hmm. I think making decisions based now on age was a big paradigm shift for us in our company, and certainly is something that I'm continuing to go forward with, because I really feel like what you said in our offline conversation about kids and their playing, you know, time is their biggest resource. It's all of our resource, right? It's the one that's the most valuable is time. We can't get that back. And I'm seeing less and less time. I'm seeing those margins of time being squeezed on all these young athletes, just like our older athletes, just like our fitness clients. It's time, 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 time. So it's really forcing us to prioritize those things. And with kids, I think we need to look through that lens of some of that age specific stuff to help us to prioritize, because what it does, it gives them bigger bang for the buck. It gives them more confidence. They walk away from a session, from a week, from a month, and they've gotten a bigger return on that investment that really wasn't all that fun. I mean, you made it fun because you know, you're making it games or whatever you're doing, but they've still got to be better for it. And when they're better for it and it's something that they notice, and it didn't take them, you know, 4 times a week for 2 hours in a sweaty weight room doing 30-minute workouts of weights and 20 minutes of condition. When you could condense that down to a 25-minute workout twice a week or a 10-minute workout once a week, are you kidding me? Why wouldn't we innovate over there? Because what's it going to do? give them big bang for buck, give them more confidence, and they're probably going to love to train for a longer period of time. And that's going to help us from a business side too. So there's a bunch of that that I think that that's a cool play space for us. And I think that's going to help us prioritize as well to look through that lens.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. Yeah. I've got one more question, and it's more about careers. I had the privilege of being invited to the University of Oklahoma just before COVID broke out, went to Norman, beautiful campus, by the way. Oh my gosh. Great. I was through the NSCA. They were doing their state clinic and they asked me to present at some in the training facility. So in any time I go on a large university like that and visit it, there is this grass is greener syndrome for me because I've been in my own brick and mortar for, you know, 26 or 27 years, whatever it is these days. And I'm like, oh boy, to work in the university setting. And I know you were there and then you went into the private sector. Do you ever think of like, do you want to return to the university at all? Do you ever get kind of drawn back in there?
I do. I do. It's part of it is the allure of running out of that tunnel on Saturday with the team that you prepared and worked with. And you know, there's part of that. There's that camaraderie of that team environment that I miss. I didn't think I would, but I have missed it. The coaches at that level and at all levels of college sports, I think right now, that their profession is really, it's a unique thing that's starting, I think, to change a little bit. And I don't know if it's the same as the old days, because with NIL, you know, some of the ways that folks can transfer and come in and out of programs now. And in some cases, some of these athletes are making more money than the coaches that are coaching them. I mean, it's pretty an interesting environment to be operating in. But I think that there's this dynamic, this human dynamic versus that's maybe different than when I was being coached in the college level and was coaching at the college level, that would be unique and would be really interesting, because I think it leverages some of the things we just talked about. It talks about innovation. We're going to have to make it better. We're going to have to make it cool. We're going to have to make it almost maybe marketable, you know, we're actually helping these athletes market themselves and create these, you know, personas for the, I mean, think about that. That's crazy talk for an old school strength coach like me. I mean, what, we're going to help you market yourself? Well, yeah, we might need to. We might need to look at that as potentially a recruiting tool for us, that, hey, come here and we're going to help you build your brand through your work in strength conditioning. I mean, that could be discussions. Those discussions may already be taking place. Not only that, but in the recruiting realm is, how are you going to develop me? You know, I need to be developed over this period of time. How are you going to develop me? How good is your development? Show me the track record of your development. Show me how you're going to keep me more available and not injured. How are you going to optimize me for game day? How are you going to handle my load management through the entire season so that I'm at my best when it counts the most? I have a feeling that these athletes are going to start asking those questions and their agents are going to, they're going to probably have agents at that point too, that are asking questions, but they should, right? If you're going to go to a collegiate program, would you like to know, hey, how good is their development? I want to know what I'm going to potentially be as a senior in that program versus another program that's doing, everybody's got their own different ways and bells and whistles and things they do, but what makes you different? What makes you unique? I think the consumer in that case is the athlete. They're going to be shopping those things more. I really do. I think they're going to be looking at those things when they're making their final decisions about where they end up going, may come down to a discussion they have with a strength conditioning professional or a physiotherapist or an athletic trainer on site that basically paints the picture for them. This is the best place for you because of this. This thing that you have, you walked in, this talented individual, we are going to develop you like you are the MVP of a Super Bowl team. I mean, that's how we're going to develop you. And now, Ken, how do we do that when there's 120 of them, you know, and we've only got X number of hours? What's the reality of that? That's where I think our previous discussion, innovation, integration of technology, collaboration, chopping things down to make them fit. Individualization, though, is probably going to be the biggest piece. How do you individualize within the bigger, you know, scale of an entire team? At the University of Oklahoma in the old days, there was no, you know, individualization of a workout. We tweaked and modified to make it individual, but there was, you know, there was no one-on-one workouts. You worked out with the team. right? I mean, you came in, you worked with a team, and that still exists, and it probably will continue to exist. But how are we going to make it even more individual for you, Rocky? When you come in with the team and you're defensive back and there's 25 of you, I need to make it Rocky's workout today, because that's what Rocky is going to be looking for. And he deserves that. I really think he deserves that. In some crazy way, I think, Rocky, you deserve Rocky's workout. Even though it's the defensive back's workout at the University of X on a Tuesday in the offseason, Rocky's still going to be looking for, how's this mine? How's this going to help me? How's this going to help my development specifically? And I think there's a real opportunity there and a challenge that you asked the question, do I miss it? I miss it. And I tell you, I get really kind of fired up, because I think we can solve those challenges. I think that's going to be a really cool thing to solve for in the next 10 to 15 years, is solving for that individualization within that big team sort of monster.
I can totally tell that you're just lit up right now. That's fabulous.
It's going to be hard. I mean, it's going to be hard. And it's easy for me to say, sitting here at my desk. I know there's people on the training floor right now that are like, that dude has no concept of what's going on here. Yeah, I do, man. I do. I get it. And I'm out here trying to think in the innovation space. I'm not trying to think about, well, this is all the problems we have. But you know, let's go down here. Let's identify why it's raining and all this. I'm going to look up here at solutions, and I'm going to continue to do that. And I think that's probably where my next chapter of my career is probably best suited, is to be up in that weirder space that sort of is trying to create some solutions for the folks that are on the front lines of this thing, and they're doing amazing stuff right now, and their challenges are exponentially bigger than what we had back in the old days. You know, I really think they are. And solving for that's going to take a lot of that, what we talked about, that innovation, that collaboration, and that iteration. So it all kind of pulls back full circle. Great question.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation. I mean, we've just been flying through the time, and I can't believe we're already at the end. But Lance, I can't wait. I can't wait to shake your hand in person in Orlando. That's going to be the first weekend of June. And for those listening, you want to get on to performbetter.com and register for the 3-day event. You're going to have a whole bunch of presenters that are just leading the way, Lance being one of them, of course, and a whole bunch more. So thank you so much for being on.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for doing this work. This is important work, and what a great resource. I wish this resource was around 25 years ago. That would have been a real catalyst for my career development. And I appreciate this. And I know people are leveraging it to help themselves be better for other people as well. So thank you for that. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Well, that brings this episode of the Zealous Podcast to a close. I want to thank Lance for coming on and having a great conversation with me. If you enjoyed his information, especially about youth sports conditioning, check our archives. About a year ago, I had him on September of 2021. Him and Bobby Walker were on one episode talking all about youth sports conditioning. In the meantime, if you find yourself in the Orlando area for the first weekend in June, be sure to register for the Perform Better Training Summit. I've been going for 10, 15 years now, and every time I get something out of it, meaning a lot. And I hope you got something out of this episode too. Be sure to subscribe, follow us on Instagram, Rocky_Snyder, and we'll see you next week.